Coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation, it's your host, Doug Hagman.
Yeah, welcome to Hagman. It is the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced. HagmanReportLive.com, HagmanReport.com. Two websites you need to know. Also, HagmanStore.com, HagmanStore.com. There you can find our line of gourmet coffees. Proceeds go to legitimate organizations, Vets for Child Rescue, Craig Sawyer's group, as well as Russ Dizdar. Two groups in the field we work closely with, and I've got to tell you, they're worthy of the proceeds, not some fictitious organization or whatever. But these are boots on the ground organizations. Coffee, gourmet coffee mugs, hyper caffeinated Detective Choice coffee. I want to start out today. Today is Thursday, February 6th of 2020, and of course, you know, the vindication of President Trump. Who didn't expect that, right? I'm not going to get into that in this broadcast. This is a very special broadcast. We're actually back-to-back appearances by Steve Quayle, which is really a great thing. I got a lot of people just saying, man, I'll tell you what, I just love him when he comes on. And as a matter of fact, I had this is pretty neat. I want to wish in advance a happy birthday this weekend to a very special woman up in Canada. You know, she says, man, you're in my head. I listen to you every day, and happened to see her, I don't know, about a week ago or so, but I wish you a happy birthday. Got a great surprise for you. I got a great surprise for you coming this weekend on your birthday. Of course, referring to Debbie up there in Canada. Lance, you got a good lady. All right. Branson, Missouri. The conference in Branson, Missouri. There's been a lot of discussion about that, right? There has been. I'm talking with Steve Quayle, we want to bring you the people that are going to appear. You get a taste of what's coming. Carl Tykrib. I don't know how many people know of him. Man, if you don't, definitely look him up. He's the author of Game of Gods, Temple of Man, In the Age of Reenchantment. He's a researcher, lecturer, focusing on the paradigm shift sweeping the Western world, okay? We're in the midst of a paradigm shift, obviously, including the challenges and opportunities faced by Christians. When you look at it from a Christian perspective, you can see what's happening, can you not? With our ideology, our belief system being bulldozed over by they're all one path to the same place. No, they're not. No. There's no coexist bumper stickers. There, coexist is just a bumper sticker. It's a lie, actually. But Carl Tykrib, over the years, has attended a range of internationally significant political, religious, and social events in his research. Now, hear what I'm saying in his research. So please don't send me emails saying, oh, he went to this or that. You know, sometimes, look, I'm an investigator. Sometimes I got to go to places that, boy, I'll tell you what. No. Christians don't go to, okay? But sadly, you know, you got to go sometimes to places you got to go to seek out information that you need to use. So with that, I'm going to bring Steve Quayle on again. I got to give Steve a lot of credit. You know, back-to-back appearances, man, it ain't easy. Actually, it's a lot harder on Steve than it is on me. So with that, I want to just welcome Steve to the broadcast. Steve, how you doing?
Excited to have Carl, you know, be able to interview him. This is the first time, by the way, nice to meet you, Carl. Obviously, being aware of his work. And, you know, Doug, I just heard the introduction, The Game of God, the title of his book. We're going to get into it. But what I think is so important is the spies were sent, Joshua and Caleb, and the spies were sent in the promised land to see what the enemy was up to. God told them to go and take the land. Unfortunately, the Christians don't understand the very nature of the land they have to go and take. They don't understand the nature of the battle. And I've read a lot of stuff in my life as a researcher, author, whatever. But I can tell you this, when I saw Carl's writings and just the list of everything that he has appeared at, the modern Christian has no clue, number one, of the battlefield. They have no clue of who their enemies are. They have no even understanding of the subtleties of the evil one, the devil. They don't understand how far this thing is advanced and how late it is in the game. So, you know, number one, Carl, what a great job. And I say great job. Listen, I don't flatter any man. You and I have never done interviews before, but I was a student of guys like Francis Schaeffer and Oz Guinness. And, you know, I'm older. I'm sure I'm older than you are. And the thing that's so impressive to me is that you know what the enemy's saying. You know what they're thinking. This isn't speculation. There's no quote, what's the word? There's no conspiracy. These are absolutely in your face facts. And yet the Christians basically don't get it. And God's word truly is, I'm going to turn it right over to you. God's word truly is so magnificent. He said his people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, but not because it's not presented to them, but they just choose not to believe it and won't even receive it and don't want to deal with it. It's like this. I'm sure glad that redemption is so awesome to us, because without that, many people saved because they don't understand the nature of the offer and the sacrifice of Jesus to deliver us from this present age. And when here's the other thing, Doug, now I'm really wound up. I'm really excited, by the way. Carl is going to be one of our keynote speakers at Branson this year. And I think the plethora of the people that are speaking and also the information is going to be different, because God's going to equip the saints this year at Branson in July for, boy, the battles that are immediately following Branson within weeks. So, again, he's gone into the enemy camp. He knows what is in the enemy's camp. And what most people don't understand, all of the gods, little g's that are coming back, are nothing more than the return to the days of Noah. So, Carl, thank you so much. Take it away. And I want you to share what's on your heart. You know, we don't have to give your biography unless you want to, but because we've got 2 hours, I want you just to cover everything. When you get a need a break, give it back to me. But I'm not here to compete with you. I'm here to, you know, interview you, and I'm excited to interview you. So number one, thank you for coming on and being a speaker of Branson. Number two, go for it until you need a break. And I just want to thank you again for the fact that if people don't understand the foundations of the biblical faith, for this purpose was the Son of God manifested that he might destroy the works of the evil one. I think people think that's like a Tinker toy set and the devil's limited to a 2-foot by 4-foot container of Lego blocks or something. Go ahead, sir.
And by the way, hi, Carl. It's Doug here. Hi, Carl. How you doing? Good to meet you.
I'm doing good.
All right. Take it away.
Well, hey, I just wanted to say, Doug, Steve, thank you for taking the time to interview me. And yes, I am looking forward to the conference coming up this summer. And I've been looking forward all week for our time together as we tackle some pretty in-depth material. I appreciate, Steve, what you were talking about in terms of the Christian doesn't know the enemy camp. The Christian doesn't know what is happening in the world today. And there is, you cannot, one man cannot cover everything that's transpiring. There is so much going on. Even this week, like right now, as we speak, this week is the United Nations World Interfaith Harmony Week. And so you've got religious organizations, political organizations, you've got a movement moving towards, we all come together as one. The world spiritually comes together as one, politically comes together as one. We will assert our oneness. And I appreciated, Steve, what you were saying. This is not conspiracy. This is not speculation. Everything is documentable. Everything is observable. The work I do takes me into the belly of the beast, so to speak, where I can see, hear, listen, and interact with the players who are involved in transforming the world. In fact, next week I will be at a very large pagan gathering, just a fly on the wall to listen to hear what is happening within the pagan world. And it's important that somebody does this so that the Christian community can have a handle of just what's coming down the pike, because the train's coming. The light's right on top of us, and we've been largely ignorant of what's taking place.
Well, I got to thank you too. And Doug, you know, the thing is that if Carl was in the pulpit, the church wouldn't be in the situation it is. I'm not saying you should be a preacher, but that's the enemy's camp. And by the way, Carl sent me a picture, Doug, which I forwarded to you to give up to Eric.
Yep.
I don't think people understand the virulent hatred, the desire to eradicate all Christianity. And in the context, you know, people look up, they blow off Matthew 24, Luke 21, Jesus saying, if days weren't shortened for the elect's sake, there'd be no flesh left alive. And yet you go to the, basically the places where they're planning, where they're showing, if you will, occult, drawings of, you know, the end of Kavanaugh and all of this weird stuff, the World Council of, what was that? The World Council of Churches over there?
Yeah, it was the World Parliament of Religions. That picture you're seeing there is from the 2018 Parliament of the World Religions. So keep in mind, everybody thinks, oh, the Parliament of World Religions, a bunch of religious leaders getting together. Yes, exactly what's going on. A bunch of religious leaders getting together, along with dignitaries from the United Nations, people from the World Bank, political figureheads, social change agents. And at the 2018 Parliament, a Baptist minister who was very upset with Kavanaugh's acceptance as Supreme Court judge, did a Buddhist sand mandala of the Hindu goddess Kali holding the severed head of Justice Kavanaugh. And around Kali's belt are the severed heads of those who confirmed him in his position. And so all week long, she worked on this Buddhist sand mandala of the goddess of death having the severed, ripped-off head of Kavanaugh. And at the end of the week, I was there for it. I've got pictures. I've got videos. You see the picture on your screen. At the end of the week, they did a dance invocation ceremony asking Kali to, in effect, destroy Kavanaugh and those who stood for what he was about. It was very emotional. The people involved in the ceremony were exuberant with this. This was something that they gravitated and held on to. So here you have a situation of roughly 8,500 religious leaders, along with members of the United Nations, more or less building the case for globalism, building the case for the concept of internationalism, all week long, evangelical Christianity was demonized, nationalism was demonized, free market capitalism was considered to be one of the greatest enemies. Jim Wallace, who is the founder of Sojourners, he gave one of the keynote presentations, and this was during the time of the U.S. midterm elections. And so Jim Wallace talked about how this election was really a battle between angels and demons. And if you were on the Republican side, you were part of the demons, and you were bringing out the worst in America. And if you were on the Democrat side, the progressive left side, well, you're the angels. And how the evangelical community has sold its soul and sold out Jesus for politics. And on and on and on he went. And it was so raw, so angering. Even people who we kind of rub shoulders with people all week long, and even some of the organizers we were talking to and the volunteers at the event were shocked by some of the language that was being used when they were portraying evangelical Christianity. We had to keep bringing it up. Look at your theme, your motto for the 2018 Parliament was the promise of inclusion, the power of love. And then all week long, all you're doing is lambasting evangelical Christians, chastising anybody who supports Donald Trump. The anger and the hate was palpable. By the way, it's a big event. The Parliament of the World Religions, I'm holding up here this is the workbook or the agenda book for the Parliament. I mean, it's a massive, massive book. Like I said, this isn't conspiracy theory. This is where the world meets. And events like the Parliament of the World Religions helps give the international community a moral standing. It gives them the justification to say, look, we can move forward with our progressive policies, with the progressive ideals, because we have the religions of the world backing us. And it's understood that when it comes to a constituent base, religions sometimes have a larger constituent base than national populations. I was at the G8 World Religion Summit back in 2010, and that was acknowledged that look, national governments may represent only a few, a few tens of million. In my case, Canada only represents 35 million, but religions can represent far more. And so if we can get religions on board with internationalism, if they can be kind of the guiding and visionary voice of the progressive left ideal, then you have a lot of power, because you can take this right down to the grassroots and then right up to the top of the political food chain and push for your concepts of global governance and world order.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting. And Doug, this is really a critical point right now. I think the New World Order has become almost trivialized in most even Christians' minds, did not realize, marginalized maybe, even of no consequence to them. But what I thought was interesting in the Mandela that you showed, that you took at that meeting, Carl, was obviously the beheading and the theme of the, even the book of Revelation, the souls under the altar crying out to God, "How long, O Lord?" And, the entire, if you will, introduction of Islamic terrorism and the beheading started with Danny Pearl openly. And then the thing is that, thank you so much, Eric, for putting that up. And I don't think people can even begin to imagine the hatred. And can I say this? How would you best define the hatred towards Jesus first and then his followers second? That's what I'm trying to see. We can't play patty cake. God bless you, my brother. Thank you for not playing patty cake with the devil.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, the thing that came out with the parliament over and over again was that we have to end religious exclusive truth claims. If you held and hold to a religious exclusive truth claim, there is no room for that. It's time to end separating faiths. The Jesus Christ is taboo in that he is the exclusive savior. Now look at God is inclusive in that he wants all to come to him, but he's exclusive in that he has one way and one way only, and that's his way. That's his way through Jesus Christ. That is anathema in the international community. And here's what people really need to get. Why does the progressive left have such an animosity towards nationalism, Christianity, the free market, on and on it goes? Why is there such an animosity there? And it came out really at the Parliament of World Religions because we stand in the way of their salvation plan. They have an alternative salvation plan. This came out right in the very last speeches given at the Parliament of World Religions. Larry Greenfeld, the executive director of the parliament, stood up. He thanked all of us in the room, everybody who was there, that we were committed to the salvation of the earth. And by saving the earth, we could save ourselves. It really is about, we are going to create a common salvation for humanity. We do it through our politics. We do it through our economic models. We do it by forcing the world to come together as one. We claim that that becomes the higher ideal, the greatest calling, building heaven on earth. And we do it in our own image. Now, that takes place in terms of international politics. It takes place within the interfaith movement. I've watched it even in the transhumanist community as the talk is there of we can raise mankind up beyond ourselves. And we can build literally a new paradise on the backs of our technology and our science. I've seen it when I've been to events like Burning Man, where for a short time, for roughly 8 days, people are living that utopian ideal. And there's so much excitement that this is the way forward. This is what we're doing to create heaven on earth. And there's a seed of that in all of these events. There's a commonality there. And so,
Carl, if I can interject a question here before you go down that road too far, maybe I missed the memo. Who do these mopes report to? I mean, these Muppets. I mean, who put them in charge?
It's what Thomas Sowell describes as the vision of the anointed. They believe that they are in charge based on the fact that they work together. They come together. They have academic degrees. They've got recognition. They do a great job. By the way, the left does a fantastic job of raising each other up, They give each other accolades and awards, and there's all kinds of hurrah, and the media picks up because the media itself is left-centered for the most part. So for an example, in 1999, Walter Cronkite received the Global Governance Award from the World Federalist Association. I talk about it in my book, Game of Gods. The World Federalist Association is the longest running pro-world government lobby group in the U.S. Now they're called something else, I think Citizens for Global Solutions. But back in 1999, Walter Cronkite gets this prestigious award. Kofi Annan is there. You have Hollywood insiders who are there. It's a big, big deal. And they raise each other up. And in doing so, they position themselves in front of the world to say, yes, yes, we're the ones who can lead the way. We're the ones who have the vision. We're the ones who have invested ourselves to save the world. And how dare you Christians get in the way? How dare you Christians balk against our ideas, your nationalism, your separating faith, your individualism? That's taboo. That's taboo. This is really rebuilding the Tower of Babel, just doing it for the 21st century.
It's interesting, too, because, you know, in your book, you talk about oneness. And I think it was the Tal Brook. I don't know if he's alive. One of his books was When the World Shall Become One. And the hatred for Jesus now is off the charts. The acceleration, do they in any of these things you go to acknowledge that Lucifer is their anointed one, their Messiah, the coming one? Or do they keep the name of Lucifer? Most certainly Satan still camouflaged to somewhat.
For the most part, that's in the background. That's a side, you know, for the most part. However, let me say this. I was at a pagan gathering, an academic pagan gathering last March. And, it was a large group of about 800 witches, Wiccans, druids, other neo-pagans. And, for the first time at this event, and I've been to this event now a couple times, they had Luciferians and Satanists brought in, recognized as equals within the pagan community, and some interesting discussions about the difference between Luciferians and Satanists. And so that was one event where Luciferianism and Satanism actually did come into play as they were discussing the rise of the pagan community.
When you look over the landscape from, wasn't it Robert Mueller's famous statement? Correct me if I'm wrong, because but when he said, give us a man who will give us peace, be he a god or be he a devil, we will worship him. Was that Mueller or somebody else that said that?
That was somebody else, but boy, that it still fits the bill. Okay. Robert Mueller had the idea that we're all working towards becoming the planet of God. I mean, Mueller was looking for a savior as well. I spent some time with Mueller back in 1997 at a youth-based world governance global citizenship conference. That was my first international event I'd been to. And Robert Mueller was considered to be like a grandfatherly figure. I mean, hey, he helped set up the structure of 11 of the United Nations specialized agencies. He was involved in the UN since its early days. And he didn't have any love for evangelical Christians either. He really was looking toward the idea that we could all have world federalism, world government, regionalism. And Steve, Doug, you know this. You see this now. You see this great tension, this clash taking place from Brexit to the streets of Paris to the universities in America. There is a clash between the big idea of global oneness and the idea of nationalism and our independent way forward.
The interesting thing to me too, just with Robert Mueller for one more statement, and again, forgive me, I used to talk about this all the time and so much stuff is him, but what was the guy that basically said by either consent or by conquest, we'll all enter into a new world order. Was that Brent Scowcroft? But he was quoting somebody else, right?
That's right. Right. He was quoting somebody else. I don't know offhand, but I know the statement you're talking about. I've read it and seen it before. Yes.
Do you think right now, Carl, that given the nature of the hatred at the unfolding nature of Antifa, and that's just the tip of the full communist uprising, how do you see the and I would call it this, it's a communist. You've got Bernie Sanders, probably one of the top two guys for the Democratic, but it's the communist, let's say this, their ability to stir up revolution and then to bring in, you know, and a lot of people think they're just atheists. No, a lot of those guys in communism are flat out Luciferians or Satanists. And obviously, how do you see right now, if you will, the timetable, in your opinion, with the events of Antifa and all of, if you will, that I call it a communism, we're talking about a pre-Civil War in the United States. How do you put that together, if you would? Because I think what I'm trying to get everyone to understand, Doug, and this helps me too, is the foundation is already there. They've already got their plans. They've already got their government. They've already got their implementation. They'll use the military. They'll use police. They'll use everybody, i.e. in America, the red, blue, and green list. But in Canada, you guys have got Trudeau now. Trudeau's trying to pass a law to shut down anything that isn't officially sanctioned or licensed. So if you can, I know that's only 100 questions, but kind of context, yeah. Hey, brother, thank you.
No, I know. We're right now witnessing some incredible pressures, some incredible tension within our culture. And anytime you see these kinds of tensions potentially explode into conflict, real conflict. And Doug, Steve, you need to keep in mind, one of the things that comes up when I have been to World Federalists and to some global governance meetings is the recognition that conflict is the engine that brings about transformation. And so it's recognized that World War I brought about the League of Nations. World War I brought about the United Nations. By the way, in both of those time periods, there was a much bigger agenda in play. During World War I and World War II, in both those events, it was believed that we would move beyond just simply a league or an association of nations, but rather we would move towards a world government. That's what was believed. That was the anticipation. In fact, here's a document from the 1940s, a just and durable peace. It was put together by the Federal Council of Churches because at that time the Christian community was on board saying what we need is world government. The only way to end global strife is for us to come together in a political union of some in some way, shape, or form. All of that said, when I see this kind of world tension that we see taking place, it speaks to the fact that we could be coming towards some type of an event where that tension explodes in a much bigger way, where it explodes between nations, between cultures. It's been going on for a long time, but it seems to be building. There's a lot of anticipation. And I know a lot of people think, okay, globalization, that concept has kind of died now that Trump's in power. No, it hasn't died at all. It's still moving forward. And the understanding is that conflict does bring about transformation. I was at a World Federalist meeting, this is back in 2012, where they were very, very, very clear that what is needed, and they said they didn't want it, but they recognized that this is what's needed, was some type of a world catastrophic event, some type of world war or some type of catastrophe of magnitude that would force us into some type of a world government scenario.
What do you see now with the Pope, just in the office and the manifestation and how he has even tried to undo 2,000 years of his own church's history or 1,700 years of his own church's history, becoming so in the face of what however many Catholics there are worldwide. But this guy, absolutely, in my opinion, I want to make this clear, I'm not asking you to agree, but in my opinion, he is the false prophet or the seat warmer for the false prophet that has come. Because every chance he gets, he's calling for global religion, one world economy. You know, he's talking about the conflict and bringing all the masses under, you know, one, if you will, Economic World Forum, and the idea of you can't have a man of peace coming on the scene until you got a man of war. So the thing is that the initiation of global war in order to bring on the Antichrist, you know, is who is in place of Jesus Christ. I see the Pope as absolutely accelerating. It's almost like this. There's almost the heartbeat is beating, you know, and they know it's coming. They know their man is coming on the scene. They know they're going to have their taste. And the scripture says it was given power unto him to make war on the saints and to prevail. That's still one I'm working out with God in my own head. Okay. But then I know with Daniel, they that know their God shall be strong and do exploits. But just how late in the game, because I'm on record as saying, and you know, all I can say is, you know, when you're right a lot of the time, not all the time, and God's giving you the stuff that you're right on, maybe people need to pay attention. It's not the messenger so much. It's the message. How quick in your own mind, you've been at this for quite a few years, going to all these meetings and stuff. But if I use the word acceleration or, you know, an increase in velocity, it's almost like great white sharks, my term, land sharks maybe, but they're sensing blood in the water. And here's how sharks, you know, they have a lateral line system, and the lateral line system of Christians, when it was strong, because we are of a strong faith, we weren't in the denial of the Lord Jesus Christ as a church. You know, there was, they had to stay out. In essence, it was like shark repellent. Okay. When you had a compromising and I would call a surrendered pulpit, then the sharks moved in for a kill. You know, a great falling away. Can you kind of address that? Because you're one of the guys that's saying, here's all the foundation. And I guess, you know, I want people to buy your book, Game of Gods. And I would say this, just from what I read, I got the PDF version. I read the chapters. I read a couple pages. I can't read the whole thing in this short of time. But I think people need to understand it's a question of power. And it is a question. Choose ye this day whom ye will follow. So if you can kind of give the acceleration mode, you know, give the your let's just say this. All these years they've been building, and now they feel like their time to strike is here, is it not?
Yeah, you know, again, that goes back to the issue of what will be the catalyst? What will be that event that brings about almost, you know, the fruition of this grand design? World War One, in the literature, there is a great anticipation. When you read through the literature of globalists during that period of time, a great anticipation during World War One that we would see the fruition of a world government. We would see the fruition of one world, of the globe coming together. You saw the same thing again with World War Two, especially after World War Two, a great anticipation that there would be some type of world system that would fall into place. Now going back to the Pope, I'm glad you brought up the Pope. I'm just going to read a little section out of my book. Listen, in 1999, I was at a World Federalist meeting where they brought in the heads also of one of the head guys from the United Religions Initiative. At that point, the United Religions Initiative was trying to become an interfaith parliament of religion, so to speak, at the United Nations. It didn't happen, but structures were put in place and ideas were kind of given as to how religions and governments could possibly come together in a world order. At that event in 1999, one of the World Federalists said, "Hey, look, the Pope and the Catholic Church has been kind of playing these games too with us for a long, long time." And then they mentioned how back in the 1950s, Pope Pius XII was on board and indeed had met with the World Federalist community in Rome. And so here's what it took me some time to find Pope Pius XII's comments, but I did. It took some time, but I've got the transcripts, and I include some of that in my book on page 353. Here's what he told. This is Pope Pius XII telling the World Federalist Community in 1951, April the 18th, meeting with the World Federalists in Rome. This is what he told them. Your movement, gentlemen, has a task of creating an effective political organization of the world. There is nothing more in keeping with the traditional doctrines of the church, or better adapted to her teaching on the rightful or unjust war, especially in the present world situation. An organization of this nature must, therefore, be set up, even if only to end the competitive rearming of nations. Okay, that was early 1950s, 1951. And already at that point, you see the Vatican saying what we need is to bring about some type of a world order. And we're with you. We're with you. We support your concept of world government. And you can trace going all the way from that point until this present pope that there is a move towards, again, the concepts of creating some type of international authority or some system of global governance. The other time period that was really critical that where the world said, look, we have, the energy moving forward and we see some kind of a horizon where we have, the world coming together as one, was that the immediate decade following the fall of the Soviet Union and the whole idea of a dividend for peace. And so in the 1990s, there was, again, a lot of anticipation within the internationalist community that what we need to do is by the year 2000 come together as the world. And so the United Nations commissioned a great big document titled Our Global Neighborhood, all about how to develop global governance. I went to the United Nations Millennium Forum. Because at that point in time, I had embedded myself so deep within some of these organizations, I was brought in as an individually accredited expert on globalization. It's when you go to these kinds of events, that's where you pick up some interesting literature. And so talking about waiting for a messiah or some type of a world leader or world king, this little document was being handed out at the United Nations Millennium Forum. And this little document is titled Transformation of the World. And I'll see if I can quickly just find a picture or two out of it. And it called for a type of world humanist king, some world leader who would come and bring all nations together under his own power. I quote it extensively in my book, but I read it to you directly from the document itself. Small doubt that the world does need a civilized coordinator in international relations and in settling global problems. More than that, this coordinator must be a stabilizing factor, actually, the last-ditch authority on the earth. He must win confidence of each man and each nation. People must be stark sure that this coordinator would solve any problem in a just and humane way, and one should be sure that in him he would find understanding and sympathy, that he would treat any nation as his own son, that he is indeed the last resort, and the man should convince his terrestrial brothers therein by his practical deeds. Can the world community do without a world coordinator? It definitely cannot.
Well, that goes along with I'll just interrupt you. That goes along with that statement. Give us a man who will give us peace, be he a god or be he a devil. We will worship him.
Right.
And again, Jesus' statement, I came, you received me not, another will come claiming to be me, the man of peace, him you will receive. So saying that and seeing what's coming, do you think we're in the event they all want? They want a World War III. They believe that they are the chosen ones. I'm talking about the world federalists. They believe they're going to inherit the planet because they are the planetary keepers. Do you see them almost, this is my word, but almost in a frenzied anticipation, even to the point of trying to bring about the provocation of World War III, i.e. the globalists, the Illuminati, the people that know even the power of the scripture that A has to come before B. In other words, a global conflagration before the appearance of the man you just read from that document. Do you think that is the case?
To some extent, I think a lot of the people who are involved in this, they believe that doing it for good intentions. And now understand, I've rubbed the shoulders with these people enough to know that there are some who are pretty dangerous people. Okay. Just put it that way. And then there's others who you might want to call the useful idiots who just believe that this is the way forward. This is what we have to do. But at the in the spiritual realm, I can certainly see that we are moving into a time period where there is a type of a frenzied movement towards bringing about some type of world system, some type of one world system. And keep in mind, there a lot of these people and these organizations, there's a practicality, a pragmatism that goes with it. And so it's a steady as she goes, move the agenda forward. This year is the 75th anniversary of the United Nations. And so I know already the World Federalists and the international community, they have been meeting to talk about what the next stage of the United Nations will look like, what type of teeth it could possibly be given. And there is this conflict. A lot of people will say, oh, well, yeah, the UN has no teeth. It's got no authority. It has no power. It's just a bunch of bureaucrats. True. But at the same time, there is a vision that it becomes something more than itself right now. And this is part of that tension that you're seeing playing out between nationalism and internationalism, progressivism and conservatism. It's part of that tension. And, it'll be interesting to see what happens if we do see a world pandemic, or if we do see a world economic collapse, or if we all of a sudden see the Middle East light up in a war that drags the world into it. Those are the types of events that will be necessary to bring about the man to come into play to say, I have a plan to move forward. But again, there is a sense across the board within the international community that this is a type of salvation. And Steve, I'm glad you brought that in. This is the antithesis. This is the opposite of Jesus Christ, because this is a self-imposed act of salvation. I'll read from Jean Stapleton. Remember the actress Jean Stapleton?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, she was a big supporter of world federalism and one world. Her, John Denver, Walter Cronkite, Lloyd Bridges. This is what she says, and I've got it quoted in my book. The goal of the world federalists, keep in mind, listen to what she's saying. The goal of the world federalists is peace through unity of government. We must support their vision of oneness in diversity, for it is the salvation of humanity. I think that's pretty telling. When you're willing to say that this vision of oneness, this vision of everything coming together, this becomes the salvation of humanity. That is a direct statement or a declaration to claim that we will create heaven on earth. We create our paradise here.
It gives a new, it gives a new meaning to the phrase stifle it, Edith. That just pisses me off. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for being so blunt about it, but you know, okay. It's interesting you say that. And Steve, I didn't mean to jump in here.
No. Jump in whenever you want.
But I mean, this morning, and I don't know where this fits. If this fits, if this doesn't fit, then just disregard it. But this morning at the National Prayer Breakfast, Donald Trump got up and I don't know if you caught this or not, but he said, I don't like people who use their faith as justification for doing what they know is wrong. Nor do I like people who say, I pray for you when they know that's not so, you know, they're not praying for you. So many people have been hurt, and we can't let that go on. That was President Trump this morning holding up the acquittal newspaper of USA Today, and about 5 feet from Nancy Pelosi's nose. He's just smacked her nose like that. But anyway, I don't know if that fits, but maybe on the smaller scale, I don't know. You're looking at it from a pretty high up view. Anyway.
Well, let me say something. Yeah, Doc.
That's good.
You brought up the United Nothings. That's what I call them. Okay. And the World Health Organization now seems to be coming to the preeminence. They may have an authority because we forget that the scripture is really accurate. The kings of the earth yield their power unto the beast. They give their power unto the beast. And let's just say this. Let's say the pandemic is real. Let's just say that. And it's way worse than it is. The fear, okay, God hasn't given us a spirit of fear, but a power, love, and a sound mind. But they're going to use the fear, in my opinion. And, you know, it's funny. We're talking, you know, for what is it, the February 6th, 2020. We've got Carl Teichrib, you, Doug Hagman, me, SQ. And right now, in the headlines of the London Daily Mail, U.S. Navy's panic. They can't find a stealth Russian super submarine off the East Coast. And, you know, it's fascinating to me because all the prophecies, you know, whether it's the Psalm 83 war or the Ezekiel 38 or whatever, the thing that bothers me, Carl, is this, is that, again, everything they have is in place. And you know what you said? A powerful statement here. I believe it was the late Bob Mumford almost 4 years ago who said, Christians are a unique group. They never have any wounded because they kill each other off. That was kind of a paraphrase. Yet you said something. It doesn't matter how wacky the tabacky, that's my word, they still, you know, want to smoke from the same packy. Okay. I mean, they don't care as long as you agree with them. No, there's no differences too great as long as you share the one with them. It's kind of like, there was a movie with, Billy Crystal where the guy kept talking about one, you know, well, the oneness, they're not talking about anything related to biblical Christianity. Have you seen the rhetoric and the vitriolic contempt increasing within their own ranks? I would say that Mandela is a pretty good example. And it's interesting, isn't it? Peace to them means the absence of us as Christians. We are the salt of the earth. The salt has lost its savor. Obviously, the light has been not put under a bushel. Good night. It's been put out into a mountain of darkness. And then I want you to address, if you would, that statement. And then also, because I'm excited, you know, I'm excited to hear what you have to say, because the foundation, you know, if the foundations be destroyed, what can the righteous do? As the biblical foundation is destroyed, this foundation that you've laid out, that you've gone to all these meetings and stuff, and Doug, I concur with you, people who will be nanny goats don't get the necessity of this kind of information. It is a foundation. So in essence, they're substituting that foundation, you know, of faith, righteousness, redemption, for their foundation of oneness. So again, you know, the thing is, pun intended, but we're just one thing away. What is that thing? Is it World War III? Is it the coronavirus? And now we've got a plague of locusts. Seriously, the plague of locusts now is headed into Pakistan. What's next to Pakistan? India. Well, you've got China with coronavirus. You've got all pretty much, I would say, North, West, and Eastern Africa being consumed by 360, 600 billion locusts, whatever. And then comes the darkness. I think God is giving us, if you would, a step-by-step return to Exodus chapter 10 and a springboard in the future. Go ahead.
Well, I'd like to return really quickly to what Doug was saying regarding the spiritual religious side that came out at the prayer breakfast. It spurred me to think a little bit about the biblical antithesis of what the world is doing. The world is looking at the idea of adopting oneness or one-ism. My friend Dr. Peter Jones has a great methodology of describing the biblical worldview versus the dominant worldview of our age. And the dominant worldview of our age is oneness or one-ism. And it says essentially this, that God, man, and nature are all fundamentally the same. There is no real distinction between the three realms. That's what oneness ultimately says. And so you see that playing out in the world of politics. You can see that playing out within the concept of sexuality, gender, family, your view on the environment, your view on ethics, morality. The list goes on. Everything in our existence is touched by that worldview in some way, shape, or form. If you hold to the concept of oneness, it will shape your worldview in all of these areas: art, entertainment. The list goes on. The biblical worldview says no, reality isn't one. Reality is two, and Dr. Jones does a great job of this. Reality is two. God. This is not dualism. This is twoism. God, and then everything that's been created. And God is distinct, unique, categorically different, completely incomparable with anything else. Reality is the creator and then the creation. Now, how you view these two things will shape your worldview in every other area of human existence, from relationships to law to economics. The list goes on. And you are seeing, and this is such a fundamental, such a simple, but not simplistic, but a simple way of looking at it. And it plays itself out in very complex manners and very complex ways. And so this is a clash. And this is the Romans 1 world that we are now seeing. Romans 1, where we worship and serve creation rather than the creator. This is being played out now before us. It's now feeding into how our culture views itself. And no wonder the Christian community is getting, you could call it, slapped upside the head, because we are, because we don't recognize that the real dominant worldview, the worldview that's been there since Genesis chapter 3, really the greatest catastrophe of human history, is saying that we can be as God, and then watching the dominoes fall because of that. We are getting slapped right up the side of the head, and we're seeing oneness in the church. We're seeing this idea being played out, expressed out everywhere around us. And there's this tension to prove that that's true. And how dare you show that there is an exclusive separating otherness to God. And therefore, there's a higher value that we have as humanity as well compared to the rest of reality. And so, it's as fundamental as this oneism and twoism, and how it plays out now, how it's demonstrated across the board. And so politics and religion, politics and spirituality, yep, you bet. They do come hand in hand, or they at least find themselves at a similar crossroad.
Do you believe at this point, Carl, that, again, given the pulpits of America primarily and the pulpits of Canada, the attempt to silence the pulpits, the acquiescence of the pulpits to want to be friends with the world, friendship with the world is enmity with God, but they are lock, stock, in step with that oneness, if you will, the oneness draw, because they want to be a part of something, but they don't want to be a part of the something of the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who saved them. Even the Scripture says, even denying the very God that saved them. You know,
so
how do you find the clergy response teams? And this is critical. Okay, you've just laid out the oneness foundation, the oneness, if you will, waiting for the right event for implementation. And now we're seeing, if you will, what's another word, the surrender of, let's just say this, evangelical Christian politics, pulpits and politics to the spirit of the age, okay? Will you address that, please?
Oh, absolutely. My goodness. The Christian community has sold itself out not to Donald Trump, though. The progressive Christians will say that's what we've done. No, we've sold ourselves out to the world in a myriad of ways way before Donald Trump ever stepped foot on the political scene. I can give you a few examples, and the one for me that really strikes home was the G8 World Religion Summit that took place in 2010. Now, a lot of people know about, of course, the G8 and the G20 political summits. Political leaders come together. They work on common policies and common frameworks. But a lot of people don't realize that in the weeks either before or during the G8 political summit, religious leaders are coming together for an interfaith summit to develop policy direction, guidance documents, and then they put that in the hands of the political leaders. There is a give and take that takes place. Well, I was at the one in 2010, the G8 World Religion Summit, and the organizations that were there, for the most part, would be representative of Christianity. So we had the Church of England, we had the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada, we had the Mennonite Church of Canada, the Salvation Army, the World Vision was there, Jim Wallace from Sojourners, the National Council of Churches, no surprises. In my country, Canada, the Canadian Council of Churches, in fact, the Canadian Council of Churches, which at that time had some of its board members as members of the World Federalist Community. They were the ones who put this together in Canada, because in 2010, the G8 summit, political summit, was taking place in Toronto. And so the world religious leaders got together in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And so you had more representation from the Christian community. The All African Council of Churches, which represents basically the entire African continent. Yeah, they were all playing politics. They were all playing kumbaya. And what was interesting was over and over again, they came to a common agreement on four, you could call it four core areas. We need a religious unity to come together for common good and world peace. We need some type of a restructuring of the global financial order. We need including a world taxation regime that was being discussed. I remember the Salvation Army speaker talking about how what we need is we need to share a bike. And she used this analogy of a bicycle. She said this. She said, it's not about having a bike for each. It's about learning to share one bike in community. Well, no, thank you. We've tried this before. It doesn't work. It sucks. It's socialism. The other plank was we need some type of eco-justice system. We have to we have to respect the gospel of nature. One of the quotes or one of the things that was said is that we as humans, we're the biggest parasites on planet Earth. We need a spiritually generated global ethic. And then finally, the fourth plank was we need to empower an international authority to manage world change, and that would be the United Nations. That was the hope at that point in time, or have the G8 potentially come together and see the political leaders of the G8 put this within a common framework. They're looking for some type of structure. They recognize they need some type of structure. They need a man to come along, don't they? They need somebody to pull this together. And that is recognized. That's understood. And so, back to the question of the Christian community, this was the Christian community in 2010. This included, in my country, one of the lead organizations, umbrella groups for the evangelical community. Did they even know what they were doing? Sometimes I don't even think they know what they're doing. They attend, they show up, they're told this is what you need to come and do. But then as the week went on, it was obvious that you had to know what you were doing. You were all holding hands, not just holding hands, but you were holding hands and singing the song of international socialism, the environmental movement. It was a watermelon event, green on the outside, socialist red on the inside.
That's amazing. Steve and Carl, approaching the top of the hour break, just want to give you a heads up here. We got about 45 seconds. All right, my guest, our guest, Steve Quayle. He's not a guest. He's part of the program. SteveQuayle.com, folks. You want to hear more from Carl, and I know you do. Go to gen6.com. That's G-E-N-S-I-X, gen6.com. There it is on your screen right there. All right. Those are for tickets for the conference. And of course, Carl Tykrib's website is gameofgods.ca. You got to get this book. It's fantastic. I mean, you will learn. You think you know, but you don't. Read that book. I'm telling you, it's fabulous. That's Game of Gods, Carl Tykrib. And again, gameofgods.ca, gen6.com for the conference tickets, True Legends. This, July 10th through 12th of 2020. We're going to be right back. Stay right where you're at.
Exposing the New World Order, you're listening to the Hagman & Hagman Report on the Global Star Radio Network. Stand by. Doug and Joe will be back shortly.
And welcome back to this edition of the Hagman Report, part two now, hour number two of the time with Steve Quayle. And I want you know, send him a thank you if you are getting a lot out of this. I know I am, but thank him, please. Send him an email and just say, hey, Steve, thanks, appreciate it. Or put your comment in the YouTube, under the YouTube video. By the way, do me a favor. Folks, do me a solid here. If you're watching this, and you check to make sure you're subscribed to our channel. And if you have been knocked off, I've been getting emails saying, hey, you know, no longer subscribe. Do us a favor. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, as well as our audio tracks, SoundCloud, Spreaker, you know, the whole, we're everywhere. So do that for us, because we, it does affect the algorithms. So, and also visit, Steve Quayle's The Q-Files 2.0. I gotta tell you, that's a marvelous, and I mean a marvelous resource of information. That's behind, well, that's a membership site. But, I'm a member, and I'm telling you, the information I get from there is just incredible. That's Q-Files 2.0, and just do that. Go there. Sign up. The link will be in the program description box. And do yourself another favor too. In advance of the conference, if you haven't signed up for the True Legends Conference in July in Branson, Missouri, July 10th through the 12th, please do so. I'll even buy you a cup of coffee when you're there. My own, though. Okay, my own. That's right. It's right here. Detective's choice. You're going to have to take it. I'll be there holding. I'll be there handing out. I can't hand out samples, okay? But anyway, Detective's choice. So conference tickets, please purchase them right away. Or if you plan on live streaming it, reserve the live streaming. I think you can do that. Just go to gensix.com. That's GENSIX.com. And, you're going to be able to see Carl Tykrib there. And in advance of that, in advance of the, conference, please as well get a hold of a copy of his book, Game of Gods, The Temple of Man in the Age of Reenchantment. This, Carl's gone where few people have gone before. And, you know, he gets sprayed up, he gets, armored up, he goes in, he, like the spy, spies in the Bible, you know, he, does the job and comes out and makes a report, and he reports to you and I. And what a fabulous service that is. At least when I did it, I got paid for it. I'm kidding. I'm not kidding. It's true. So you can pay him by, purchasing his book, and I highly recommend it, Game of Gods. Let me tell you, you think you know, you don't know. Get the book. All right. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Steve, Steve Quayle, stevequayle.com. Steve, go ahead, sir.
Well, again, going in the second hour here, I want to share something with everybody. The God Who Is There and He Is Not Silent was a really prominent book in the early 70s. And the thing is that God is still there, but his people are silent. But I thank God for men like Carl Tykrib. And I'm sorry, I won't apologize for this. God gave him the cojones to do what he does. And all the keyboard warriors, I doubt they could stand up to all that he's had to stand up with. So God, you know, again, God has a specific person for a specific job at a specific time, and we all play a part. Carl, if you don't mind, I would like to have you segue into transhumanism now, okay? And just something funny for both you guys. Someone said, well, now we've seen trans republicanism in Mitt Romney. He just had a transformation. So he's a transpublican. I thought that was pretty funny.
And you know, Steve, just real quick, that's a perfect example of somebody using their so-called religion as a catalyst for doing something that, to me, well, that I believe he did it for the purpose of attaining, you know, the office and revenge and stuff. It's for the wrong reasons, but they cite their faith for doing so, and it's a weaponized faith. And you're right. So I just wanted to throw a thousand in there. I'll shut up now. Go ahead.
No. And I think, Carl, I'll just shut up too, because I want to hear it. This is a treat for me, so thank you. Address transhumanism, because right before the very eyes of everyone, everything that God created is going to be recreated in the image of man in the oneness. But transhumanism has been such an in-your-face fulfillment of the days. If the days weren't shortened, there'd be no flesh left alive. Yet it's like, forgive me, most pulpits, you know, how can you tell if some place is void of the truth? The greatest quarantine for truth, in my opinion, next to mass media is in the pulpits of that which used to claim to represent Jesus Christ. So there's a truth quarantine in the majority of pulpits in America. But let's talk about transhumanism, please.
Yeah, sure. I've spent some time interacting with transhumanist leaders. I've interviewed a number of them. I've been to a few transhumanist events. I've been to transhumanist events both in the virtual world of Second Life, because that is a place where transhumanists do meet up, especially the Terrasem community, which is a trans religion put together by Martine Rothblatt, the founder of Sirius XM Radio, who's a rock star within the transhumanist movement. And I've been to transhumanist events, both in Salt Lake City and in New York City. Salt Lake City, because there is a Mormon organization dedicated to transhumanism. And in New York City, I was fortunate to attend the Global Future 2045 International Congress, which was like the concert, the rock show of the transhumanist community. This was back in 2013, like kind of the pinnacle of the transhumanist community coming together, leaders from MIT, individuals, figureheads from Yale, from Harvard. We had Marvin Minsky, was streamed into us via a video feed. Oh golly, there was a lot of people. Ray Kurzweil, director of engineering for Google, who's a rock star in the transhumanist community. He gave an address to us, and there's this great hope that through our science and our technology, we could direct evolution. We don't want evolution just to lead us around willy-nilly. We want to direct evolution. We want to take and forge ahead and create ourselves in our own image. That's really what this boils down to. And so it's based on the premise that evolution is true, based on the premise that we can now direct it. And then thirdly, that we can become immortal, potentially become immortal, potentially become godlike in our outcome. And that is absolutely rife within the transhumanist community. This idea that we are becoming godlike through our science and our technology. And the technologies that are out there are pointing in a direction that says we are remaking the world. And how that plays out is really interesting, because it's an always changing environment. I go to some other events that have a bit of a crossover with the transhumanist community. I go to Burning Man. I've been to Burning Man since 2017. If everything works out, I hope to reattend this year. But 2018, the theme for Burning Man was iRobot, asking that question: can man and machine integrate? Can our technology and our devices, can they shape us? And do we shape them in turn? And so there was a lot of workshops, a lot of networking kind of events, places where you could get kind of meet up with people who are some of the thinkers of just where technology is taking us. And so I see transhumanism as a very important, having a very important role in reshaping, well, certainly reshaping how we think. It's connected all of us. It is a type of proof test to tell the world, look, we can all come together and we will do it digitally. And we are all coming together. Now, I'm not against technology. My goodness, we're using technology right now. It's not an issue of what type of technology we're using here. We're using technology. We understand it. We understand its benefits, but it's taking the technology that we have and saying, just as in Genesis chapter 3, we can become as God. And that's the problem.
Yep. That's a problem. And, you know, in the whole confounding of the languages at Babylon, and obviously AI is going to be a global language. I believe, by the way, AI, and just, this is kind of interesting, AI, alien implant, and why this is critical is the involvement, if you will, of organic and, and non-organic material, the melding of the two, and it's to take us away from everything that God created. So, I mean, these guys want to do everything. Smart dust, they want to spray everything with smart dust, know what's out there, maybe stuff they haven't found yet, and take it all away. The devil wants to destroy every last vestige of the creation that God did in the book of Genesis. And so it's fascinating to me, again, and I want to get your feedback on this, that the transhumanists are telling you in their face, by the way, then there are the big four that are headed to Mars and Moon and everything, and they're going, well, we've made a mess of this planet, let's go to the next one. You know, we've strip mined planet Earth. How does that even fit in? Are you seeing amongst Burning Man and some of the other, the quest to escape planet Earth because, quote, mankind has destroyed it, and now they must go to another planet, i.e. Mars, or, you know, one of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, and to recreate a new world of their making?
Hey, you know something? Chapter 13 in my book is entitled Machines of Loving Grace, which is probably, I mean, it's well over 200 footnotes long. I've got the thing well documented. It's probably one of the most concise history and exploration of the present transhumanist movement. What's fascinating with even the space industry, if you take a look at its history, especially on the Russian side, that the very seedbed, intellectual seedbed of the race to space has some footing within the ideas of transhumanism. The Russian cosmonauts, there was an intellectual side to it through a Russian esoteric philosopher who came up with a concept of cosmism. And this is from, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s. And it helped birth the Soviet Union's space program. It helped give a kind of an intellectual edge to their space program, saying space is not just simply about going into a new frontier. It's not simply to colonize a new planet or to go and explore, you know, the world beyond Earth. No, there's something more going on. And that is, it is a symbolic act of man being able to ascend and man moving upward. We are projecting ourselves. Space becomes a metaphor for the ascension of humanity, that evolutionary progress. And so within the transhumanist movement, and going back to the cosmos movement and even the thinking, the intellectual thought pattern of some of the early cosmonauts in the Soviet space program, it was an understanding that space becomes, by being able to enter into that realm, we become more than man. We are now starting to project ourselves. We're going to become truly a universal species. So some really crazy and at the same time intricate and interesting patterns of thinking that's taking place. It's not just simply looking to set up a set of low orbit satellites or something. Right. Or a base. There's a worldview. There's a worldview that's already underscoring or undergirding the practical outpouring that you see taking place. So yeah, I mean, there's more to it than meets the eye intellectually, specifically from a spiritual, philosophical point of view. The concept of using our technology to extend ourselves ends up having a type of a spiritual basis to it. I'll give you an example of how some of this can kind of dovetail. This kind of breaks away from the whole space side of it. When I was at the 2018 Burning Man event, I went to a workshop by one of the intellectual leading lights of the cryptocurrency community. By the way, there's a lot of talk at Burning Man on cryptocurrency, a lot. And this gentleman, and he gave a talk that took place over the period of roughly 2 hours. There's Q&A. There's probably 50, 60 people in the tent. It turns out a lot of them were well positioned within Silicon Valley. Burning Man really is Silicon Valley's event. And so this leading light within the cryptocurrency community broke down in the space of 2 hours, four building blocks to a new civilization. He had just returned from an ayahuasca experience, from a psychedelic experience. And so He was bringing that into play, bringing a new spirituality. And these are the four building blocks. I'm just paraphrasing because it was a big deal. The four building blocks he described are this way. First, a new spiritual foundation, a new spiritual vision. That's block number one. Block number one is psychedelic. It is Eastern. It is mystical. It is goddess-based, no longer Judeo-Christian. It is the mystical returning. That's block number one. That's the new spirituality that we need to adopt in a world whose dominant position is oneness, implied or otherwise. Block number two, we need a new social ethos, a new social restructuring. That's what's happening at Burning Man. That's what's taking place within the culture all around you. You're seeing a brand new social culture forming itself, and you're seeing this clash taking place. Everything from sexuality and gender to family structures, and all of this is played out at Burning Man to some extent. So we have block one, a new spirituality. Block two, a new social ethos. Block number three, he described as what we need is a type of global cryptocurrency or some type of global digital currency tied in to block one and block two. So your purchasing behaviors need to reflect the new spirituality and the new social ethos. How will you manage all of this? How will you allow somebody to buy and sell and to keep all of this moving within a new global order? Artificial intelligence. It's AI. Mm-hmm. And so we brought all four of those into play in the space of 2 hours. And like I said, I'm just paraphrasing. A new spirituality, a new social infrastructure, a new social ethos, a new economic governance form, because that's what that is. This is economics and governance coming together. And then all of this being managed through artificial intelligence, which is one of the main building blocks of the transhumanist community as well. The potential direction that AI can give. So it was, I walked out of that, Steve, Doug, I walked out of that event with my jaw dragging on the ground because it was put together in this four-stage package that I could grab and grab hold of, and I realized, okay, and then so much of this was couched around the idea of coming together into the singularity. What will the singularity look like? Well, in a sense, he just gave that from his perspective. Now, will it shake down exactly like that? Probably not. But the very fact that this is what's being described, what the hope is. This is the path of salvation for them. No, thank you. No, thank you. I don't want to be just another number.
Steve, I don't know about you. Carl, what you're saying is this is not some organic grassroots, sex, drugs, rock and roll, Woodstock on steroids kind of thing. This has got some oomph to it.
Oh, Doug, it has oomph, lots and lots of oomph. Yeah. Of all the events I've been to, and I've been to 35, 40 different events, maybe more. I don't know. I sent you a small list. I know that, but I know I missed stuff out. Burning Man has probably been one of the most intriguing in that you're seeing spirituality, politics, economics, new social thinking, all taking place at the same time. Burning Man, typically there's three types of people who go to Burning Man. Just the partiers, those who are coming, call it for the sex, drugs, rock and roll. Then the second type of people coming to Burning Man are those who are spiritually seeking, those who are looking for something. And then the third type of person who seems to go to Burning Man and who gravitates to it are your tech entrepreneurs, your social change agents, those who recognize that there's something bigger going on than just a party in the desert, because there is something way, way bigger. Just to help you wrap your head around that. Last year, I spent 2 hours in a great conversation with the European Union liaison officer to the U.S. federal government at Burning Man. Last year, the World Bank's chief economist from 2016 to 2018 was at Burning Man because he saw Black Rock City, the city infrastructure built around that event, as being the leading light for a World Bank concept called developing charter cities, new international economic hubs that could be placed within developing nations. We had 52 U.S. mayors touring the city last year to see how they could implement the concepts being learned at Burning Man and bring it back to your American cities. At least four congressmen that were touring Black Rock City at the time. So there's a lot more going on. I mean, way more going on, Steve, than just simply a bunch of kids partying.
Wow. Steve, do you know that? I mean, did you realize that about Burning Man? Because I didn't.
But I did know this. It was, in essence, I saw it, Carl, until you explained it. I saw it more as, if you will, the techno kingdom, the kingdom of technology, but being surrounded by a bunch of techno serfs, okay? In other words, neo-feudalism, but in a techno-feudalistic way. But I think what you're saying is true. And the fact that you said the EU was going to be there, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, because the EU was present at the, you know, the dedication of CERN and an anniversary. You saw, I'm sure you saw the ceremony that took place at the CERN tunnel, where basically you couldn't have embraced Lucifer in any more lovely a manner than that. And then yet I see the ongoing, if you will, what should I call it? The integration, I'll tell you what it is, the fornication with evil spirits. It's like there's a supernatural unseen hand that's taking this part in Europe, this part in the United States, this part in Canada, part in South America, part in Peru and ayahuasca, you know, trips into the Never Never Land. And, you know, and then they're waiting for the Mad Hatter. So given, you know, and what was the date? This is the thing. How do they see, I'm not asking a set of time, but how soon do they want this integrated?
Oh, 2030, but really right now. But 2030 is the big date. Last year, my team and I, we some of us went to a workshop on 2030, the Sustainable Development Goals at Burning Man, because they've got workshops geared just for that. And it was interesting. It wasn't so much of a workshop, more of a celebration of what the world will be like in 2030. And so, the moderator for that event, was a well-known international businessman, deeply connected to the World Economic Forum. And he was there guiding the discussion we had members of very, very prominent doctor who was representing, kind of the health side. We had educators, we had people involved in the cryptocurrency side, and all of them were expressing how we're all moving together towards 2030. And 2030, in their view, is the goal. It's the year that hopefully the world can actually become unified or united in some respect. And that's not that far away. That's only 10 years away. Now, will it happen in 2030? I don't know. There was hopes of this taking place already by the year 2000. It didn't happen. Nonetheless, this is the kind of thing being discussed. This is what's happening. What was fascinating in that workshop was the recognition that now Burning Man, and again, I mean, there's all kinds of people going to Burning Man for all kinds of reasons, but it was acknowledged, openly acknowledged, that the children of the billionaires of yesteryear, who had their own vision of world order, those grandchildren and children now come to Burning Man, where they can network, where they can come together, and where they see themselves now formulating a new vision, a new direction, a new world order in built for our time right now. So Burning Man, to me, Burning Man is a party, absolutely, but it's more than that. It's a proving ground. It's a testing ground. It's a place for ideas to be circulated. It's kind of a combination of the World Economic Forum meets the Esalen Institute, meets your backyard, because, you know, it's a reflection of the culture around you already.
Why the symbology of the Burning Man? Okay. You know, my immediate response is that basically they're getting rid of the old that God created and bringing in the new that they created. That may be inaccurate, but that's what I thought.
You know, I don't think you're that far off, Steve, because it's understood. Well, first of all, the organization behind it says there is no meaning. Mean whatever you have How do I say this? You can attach any meaning to it you want, so to speak. But it's also understood that the rite, that the act itself is a symbol of generation, regeneration, birth, death, rebuilding, that there is a humanist vision moving forward, that man becomes more, that man becomes something else, that we are all engaged in that act of being redefined over and over again. And so there's more at play than just simply, hey, we're having a bonfire.
Yeah. Well, again, immediately when I saw it, I thought of, the Druid wicker ceremonies of human sacrifice, because burning men, they would make tall men like that, maybe not that tall, but, very much over human size, and put a bunch of people in them, burn them alive to their demons and devils. So in essence, basically, it can be almost like, if you will, a bonfire. And I'm not trying to make it more than it is, but it says a lot of things. So I guess if you went in there as someone who is a druid, you'd know it exactly what it meant. If you went in there as a student of comparative mythology, you know it exactly what it meant. And basically, it's out with the old, in with the new. That's what I see.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that perspective, because that really is, I think that's what it is. It is out with the old and in with the new. There's no hiding that aspect of it. Back to the transhumanist side. What's interesting, and why I brought Burning Man up, not just simply that workshop where we talked about a new infrastructure with four building blocks, but what's interesting is this is the place where the technology world comes. This is where the gurus of Silicon Valley come for inspiration. This is the place where they come to network, to relax, to find a common ground, and so. In terms of just some of the technological interplays that take place, an example, Elon Musk took his Tesla Roadster there before it was introduced to the public, and had it parked at Burning Man so that the world could see, that the burning community could see. Yes, this is one and the same with Silicon Valley. Elon Musk has made that very clear, that Burning Man is Silicon Valley. And in fact, if you claim you get Silicon Valley, but you've never been to Burning Man, there's a disconnect because the two are intermingled so tightly. Google's very first doodle, and you all know what a Google doodle is. On Thanksgiving, you open up your Google webpage, your search engine, and there's turkeys and pumpkin pie and all that good stuff. That's a Google doodle. The very first Google doodle was 1998, and it was the image of the Burning Man, because that was the founders of Google saying to Silicon Valley, we're burners first. And indeed, that was the week that Google was incorporated as a company, and Google executives were saying, hey, our attorneys, they're looking after this corporate structuring. We're heading off to the desert because we're burners. When Eric Schmidt became the CEO of Google, making Google what it is today, his resume floated to the top because he had Burning Man on his resume. And then they took Eric Schmidt out to the desert, out to Burning Man, to see, okay, did he get it? Does he understand it? Because if he could get Burning Man, which looks like a chaos, which looks like chaos, but really, it's, if you took a top-down approach, it's almost like nodes of information, nodes of connections that are found within the chaos. If he could get Burning Man, he could get Google, because essentially the two have a lot of overlap. And so there's this incredible connection between the Silicon Valley and what happens at this particular event. And by the way, Burning Man is just one of many, and I talk about this in chapter 14 of my book. I pinned something to the effect of 265 transformational events that took place from 2013 to 2016 in Canada and the United States alone. It's a global phenomena. A lot of these events are quite small, but you have a few that are the mothership type events. Burning Man is one of them. And what it is, and this is so important, gentlemen, for you to understand, what this is a reflection of what your neighbors already believe, what your culture has already accepted. It's a reflection of it, and then it's a refinement as they project it back into society. This is not just simply, these events are not just simply one-off events. It reflects the movement of our time.
How is it too expressed in video games? I know I want to make a confession here for everybody. I've never played a video game in my life. I have that's true. Yeah, I take that back. I played Pong for probably 5 minutes when it first came out, you know. I mean, with ADD, trust me, it's not worth my time. But the point is that how does a video game, if you will, world, because that's even bigger now in its scope and reach than what cinema was to those of us who are, I guess you'd say, what Marshall McLuhan would say, those of us who are programmed, or I call it mediated, like media and fornicated, okay? So I should maybe make it better than that. But how do video games now, too, because the youth are raised in a totally virtual world, pretty much divorced from history, divorced from what I would call a working knowledge of how things really work in the world, because they're playing it, they're sitting in mom and dad who's worked their lives off. They're playing on their 60-inch screen with I don't know what games cost, blah, blah, blah. Address video games, because I think that has been, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the most transformational, important developments in this whole move to what you're describing.
Oh, no question. I don't write about video games in my book. Not really. I mentioned Second Life just a little bit. It's not really a video game. It's a virtual reality platform. But you're absolutely right, Steve. Video games have a language. They're speaking something. They're projecting a worldview. Look, I teach a course. I just taught it not that long ago. I teach a 20-hour modular course on secular pagan trends at a Bible college in Western Canada. I just got finished it a couple of weeks ago. My class, I had a class this year, roughly 50 students, and many of the students acknowledged they're gamers, and as the week went on, they went, oh, what you're talking about, these worldviews, these secular pagan worldviews, oh yeah, this is absolutely part of our video game. This is the worldview that I'm actually playing in. And so there is a worldview that can be expressed through video games that can be very, very powerful. And you play the game, you don't even realize that you're entering into scenarios, ethical, moral scenarios that project a particular worldview or that force you to make decisions within a worldview. So it's very subtle and at the same time, quite provocative.
Doug, do you want to answer that, or because I don't want to control?
No, you know, I just find this absolutely incredible. By the way, when you mentioned video games, just as an aside, there was a gentleman who wrote one of the first books about how video games adversely impact society, and that's, he's an attorney out of Florida, and I did some undercover work for him. Into the book. So I see what you're saying here. All of the components, all of society, I suppose, Carl, there are demonic assets, I suppose, they've infiltrated all elements of our society and are pushing society, people, our belief systems, our government, everything toward this objective, this unified objective of this global governance kind of thing. And that's what you're saying, right? That's what you're finding.
Yes. Bottom line is this. Your worldview, if your worldview is oneness, that man, God, and nature are all the same, then all of these things that we've just been describing, it sounds like the move towards a type of utopia, a type of perfection on earth. If reality is two, God and creation as two separate, distinct facets of reality or aspects of reality, then you see where the clash really takes shape, because then you have two opposing salvation messages.
Amen. I think that's really critical, because there is salvation, no other name. But here's the thing. The virtual world, remember, Doug, there are people, and I mean, I know you know this, but there are people who get so entrapped in the virtual world that their whole identity is supported by the fellow gamers. And they have absolutely a programmed ethos. They have a programmed response. And also, I want to deal with the violence. It will come to pass. You know, we used to talk about hypnotism, CIA, mind control, MK Ultra and stuff. But that went way, that's blasé, not blasé, but it's way in the past as far as history. Now you have a control mechanism going on, and I would say at a spiritual, physical depth. In other words, I believe there are evil. The ghost is in the machine. I'll call them demons. And I think that people, and some of them that are so profane, I've been told this by gamers before the Lord. I don't know the games by name, you know. But the virtual world, I would say this, is the ideal playground for the devil to control, contain, and basically render useless anybody that could have made a difference. Because there are some really bright guys playing video games. Bright, bright people. But the divorce, Carl, how would you define this? You do a better job than I do. The divorce between reality, the real world, the empiric world, and then now we got to deal with the virtual world. And I believe the virtual world has overtaken the youth of this day at the opposition of the real. So they can call it cognitive dissonance all they want. I think it's deeper than cognitive dissonance. I think it's basically they're in a, and you know, somebody said, well, they're in a whole different world. That's literally, literally true.
Yes, yes, it is an alternate reality. It's not that they are in, it's not that, how do I say this? It's not that they are in a non-reality. There, it is a reality. It is a digital reality. But it is an alternate reality. On the question, going back to the question a little bit on transhumanism and how some of this all plays out, I've got in my book two examples from Esalon. As they were taking a look, now this goes into the realm of spirit and machines. The Esalon Institute is, well, I have to back up. The Esalon Institute is incredibly important. It's on the shores of California. It kind of was the engine, intellectual, spiritual, psychological engine for the counterculture. It became in the 1980s. I talk about this in Game of Gods. It became in the 1980s a conduit between the Soviets and the Americans. It played some really interesting roles in terms of the 1980s and Mikhail Gorbachev, the movement to perestroika. It helped change Mikhail Gorbachev's own worldview towards accepting oneness, and that's documented in the book. But by the 1990s at the Esalon Institute, they were having workshops asking the question of our technological, techno-spiritual future. Here are two workshop descriptions. One's from 1993, one's from 1996. This is the workshop entitled Machine Dreams and Techno-Shamanism. Is information immortal? What unexplored realms of spirit will we encounter with amazing new forms of computer and electronic hypermedia? New myths will be needed. New mysteries will be encountered. How can ancient models of mind such as shamanism, Hinduism, or voodoo help us comprehend silicone-based consciousness? Why are neuroenhancers crucial tools for so many computer innovators? Can humans share an erotic relationship with machine beings? Are Earth spirits at play in fields of photons and electronic spin? A neo-psychedelic subculture is co-evolving with new technologies to reveal glimpses of exotic futures. That was that's a 1993 workshop at Esalon, as they understood that society back in 1993 was moving towards this new spiritual, techno, religious, cultural type of evolution. Here's a 1996 workshop entitled Techno Shamanism, Total Immersion in Spiritual Technology. To wholeheartedly embrace technology may be the only way to partake in the next phase of human evolution. Participants will experience brain machines, the internet, computer fractals, virtual reality, tarot, astrology, and I Ching through computer programs, chaos math, hemispheric alignment audio, video games, and even new media. The workshop will explore the techno vision quest and evaluate it as an adjunct to more traditional spiritual practices. The weekend will conclude with a techno-pagan rave dance. Participants are encouraged to bring at least one item of technology. We kind of giggled with that one. But back, you know, this is back in the 1990s. This was understood. I mean, Esalon was the cutting edge of where the cultures, you know, the cultural thinkers and cultural leaders and the futurists would gather. And that's what they were already envisioning. Boy, doesn't this sound like today in some respects?
Oh, I think that was a roadmap to where we are now. And I think that it's really critical because, you know, again, when I wrote the book Terminated, The End of Man is Here, the whole thing about sex robots, it wasn't the fact that it would be sex with a mechanical, you know, automaton or robot like people think of robots, but it wasn't the ghost in the machine. It was a demon in the machine. We have that in classic mythology, literally a robot with a spirit in it. So the thing is that, you know, when I love that, because when you're dealing with photons, electron spin rate, you're dealing with the fabric of creation there. And so then you're also getting into the, if you will, the manifestation of a demon, a disembodied spirit, or of a fallen angel. You're dealing with spiritual forces interacting with what used to be considered just purely physical machines or the work of men's hands. But then again, you know, God prepared Adam's body, Jesus, I believe, literally, you know, Colossians 1:16-17, and then he breathed into them breath of life. Breath, obviously, in Greek, is spirit, and obviously in Greek, pneuma, and in Hebrew, ruach, okay, that exhalation. So if that's the case, and everything the devil does and is doing and will do to bring about the ultimate deception, then he's going to absolutely figure out his way of doing the same thing with machines. And, you know, when you've got snuff bots, robots, when you've got all the perversions, I won't go into them, but, you know, Carl, when I wrote Genetic Armageddon 20 years ago, people just thought I went over the edge. And so my answer to that is, yeah, and guess what? I saw it was over the edge, and you were too afraid to approach the edge. I'm saying that, Doug, for the people that don't email me or Doug Hagman. What you just heard, ladies and gentlemen, is probably one of the most real, I'd say this, in the flesh testimonies of someone who is called to do what he's doing to get people to think beyond what they know, to prevent information they'd rather not know, but it's going to affect everything. It's like, you know, I'm a dad, I'm a father, I'm a grandfather. Doug, you're a father, grandfather. I don't know, do you have grandkids too? Carl?
No, I don't.
Okay, so, and I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, but I'm just saying this. nobody seems to even, I'll say this, even in Christendom, there seems to be no concern for the next generation. I don't know. I would call that a genetic fatalism, a biological destiny, a saying, well, God said repopulate the earth and we're going to depopulate the earth. Almost, if you will, a forced sterility, both in mind and in physical function. That's really being tactful for me.
But, you know, the question for myself as a believer, as a Christian, and I think this is something that we all have to wrestle with, is now what is our response to this? Not what is our reaction, because that's all we've had, our reactions. And the reaction has typically been hide our head in the sand. We don't want to hear about it. We don't want to know about it. What happens, though, when we hide our head in the sand, besides the fact we can't breathe? Well, number one, we don't see the dangers or the opportunities, even if they stand right beside us. The other thing we have is our rear end is exposed. It's up in the air, and it's going to get kicked. And boy, has it been kicked. Yeah. So, you know, the typical reaction has been we hide our heads in the sand. Now, I understand, you know, especially pastors, they're busy. Their churches, their flocks have got issues. They're counseling. They're dealing with the politics of their own church. There's a lot of pressure there. That doesn't excuse the fact that as Christians, every single one of us, we are called to know the times, to understand the times, and we are called to be salt and light in the community wherever and whenever we find ourselves. I make the argument in the book, and this is something I have to flesh out possibly with another book down the road, what it means to be an ambassador for Christ. Because that's the response. That's not a reaction. That's a response. Being an ambassador for Christ, it's interesting. I had the opportunity a number of years ago to sit in a workshop or a lecture given by a U.S. ambassador. He was the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia during an event at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. And he was describing all of the aspects of his new position. And I walked away from there going, there's a lesson here for Christians. First of all, what does it mean to be an ambassador? We know Paul uses comparative language. He uses the language of we run the race. We're soldiers for Christ. He uses the language of we're laborers for Christ. We get that. But what does it mean to be an ambassador? First of all, he doesn't say it in an allegorical sense. He says you are an ambassador. So what does an ambassador do? Who is an ambassador? Well, you are an ambassador, Steve. Doug, you're an ambassador. Every Christian listening to this is an ambassador. And first and foremost, an ambassador is the legal and official representative of their government. You literally are the legal and official representative of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords on earth. There is no higher calling than that, period. Then what an ambassador does is he takes the time to know his own king's power and position. He understands what his king's position, what it is, and he represents his king's power and his king's position, not his own. In fact, you take and you subservient your own ideals and your own goals for the higher goal of the kingdom. And then thirdly, an ambassador, because you find yourself in a foreign land, sometimes that land is hostile to the message of the king, and now ours is. That ambassador takes the time to know the culture, to know the setting, to know the history, enough that you're able then to be able to communicate the king's message effectively. Doug, Steve, what are we doing here in the last 2 hours? My hope is that we're showing Christians who are listening and watching this right now, that it is imperative that we know the times, we know the culture, so that we can begin to speak truth into it while the world is offering an alternative salvation message, that we can therefore say, hey, you know, I can see where this is going. The writing's on the wall. Let me tell you, as somebody who's taken the time to understand and unpack some of this, to now give you an alternative view to what the world is giving you. So it's important, it's absolutely essential that we become ambassadors and retake that meaning and actually become the salt and light to the world that we're supposed to be, that city on a hill. When we go to Burning Man, I go with a small team. We go not just simply to do research, though for me, that's my heartbeat. I'm a researcher first and foremost. But we set up a tent, we set up a sign at our camp. And the sign is taken from the book of Acts. In Acts 17, Paul demonstrates what it looks like to be an ambassador in a pagan culture. He goes to Athens, he goes to Mars Hill, and there he sees all these temples and idols to various deities. And he then uses that to launch into the gospel. And in fact, he even tells the Athenians that he recognized that they had a monument set up to the god, to the unknown god. And then he uses that as leverage to go into the gospel of Jesus Christ. He went in as ambassador. He recognized their spiritual situation. He recognized their culture. He even quotes their own philosophers and poets as he then proclaims the character of God, the nature of man, and the finished work of Jesus Christ. So we set up a sign at Burning Man. Our sign is this, Camp of the Unknown God. And then all week long, we use that as a leverage point to go into, have conversations and to go into the message of Jesus Christ. And we use concept of oneism and twoism oftentimes to help bring that conversation into play. And it's interesting to see how for the most part, people have been receptive, not necessarily accepting, but at least very interested because the world is searching. The world is searching. All of this said, why do we want to understand and try to wrap our heads around transhumanism, global governance? Why do we try to unpack what's happening in terms of socialism, the environmental movement, paganism, all of these seemingly different subjects, yet they all converge, they all come together on the concept of oneness. Why are we taking the time to understand this? Number one, so we can be better equipped to be ambassadors, so that we can be the ones who are the salt and the light. Quit having our rear ends kicked.
Amen.
Anyways, my tirade. Sorry, guys.
No, Steve, that's really what this is all about. Is and I'm glad Carl addressed this. Is go in, research, investigate, report, and then respond. And he's talking about the response, and the proper response as Christians. And I thought, I'm glad he addressed that. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, you can't send anybody out to battle if they haven't gone to basic training. You can quote Ephesians 6 until you're blue in the face and never encountered, how do I say it, and never encountered with the gospel of an ambassador. Remember this, an ambassador also has the country it represents and the army of that country to back it up. Therefore, you're dealing with legal authority versus functional authority. You know, what we've seen even in a mode of the world, even with our State Department, our ambassadors became corrupt. So everything that our ambassadors represented for whatever reason, whether it was espionage, military, instead of building hospitals, obviously people are buying off this person, that person. That's a pretty accurate statement over the State Department. We all know Hillary Clinton's excesses and license with it. But I do not believe that anybody still preaches what Carl just said. When you go ye forth into all the world as the Great Commission commands, you're going forth as ambassadors. But problem is people are going forth, at least maybe they'd like to go forth, but they have, in my opinion, they don't have a revelation of what it means. They don't have an application of the power to their own life. They don't understand when Jesus said, I send you out as sheep among wolves, you know. I don't think that, again, I believe the pulpits have produced impotence, okay? And again, Doug, you know, a new motto for your show is, you know, the Hagman Report, where the truth is not quarantined. Because when you're watching anything, when you see that word quarantine, and anything coming out of any official publication, media, radio, television, outside the alt news, and that's why the war is on alt news. Because, you know, Carl, we're seeing a vilification of the Bible. We're seeing the vilification of, obviously, believers. We're seeing a new freedom to slaughter Christians all over the world, martyr them. We're seeing no open protest from the biggest mega churches in the United States. I don't know about other places. We have brethren who are in China being exposed to a biological weapon, in my opinion, from the Wuhan Biolab. We have people in Iraq who still love the Lord Jesus as much as I do, as much as we do. We have people all over the world that are suffering. And because of us, now I think too, Carl, I think that contrasted, that's what the devil's doing. That's what they think they're going to get away with. But I call this reality interruptus, okay? God has a way of saying, you know, to a couple grasshoppers, I think it's time to send a little bit of famine. Now, I know he's not willy-nilly, but all of the manipulation of the weather, you know, and people fight me. They say, well, what's God doing? What's man doing? I said, the Bible says God takes the evil ones in their own devices. So the point is they're out manipulating the weather. And now you've got, when it did look like China's having a real problem, if that locust plague goes into Pakistan and then into India, then you got half the world having a problem. And their half of the world having a problem, they look at, Canada's got food. Somebody once said, when goods don't cross borders, armies do. But unfortunately, that which calls itself, I call it claimants, okay, to Christianity, haven't even begun to understand the Great Commission. They understand it as the great submission to the powers that be. And that's why Romans 13 and, you know, the misapplication of who's the final authority over a Christian's life. Well, obviously, Caesar said it's me. And obviously, the martyr said, no king but Jesus. So will you, and we got how many minutes, and I'll just give it to you to finish out, Carl. How many minutes do we have left, Doug?
What's that?
How many minutes do we have left?
We have 5 minutes. I was checking with Eric, the tech. We have 5 minutes.
So if you don't mind, with your permission, I'll turn it over to Carl, or we'll turn it over to Carl. Carl, close it out. And that's like when I sent you an email, I said, say whatever you think is the most pertinent part. When we get through, say what you got to say, because people have got to hear this. My prayer is that you will be heard in the context that it will be a wake-up call for the people.
Hey, you know, the most important thing for us to do is even as believers to wrestle through, do we accept the worldview of oneism and all of the all of the things that portrays, or do we accept the reality of the biblical worldview that says God is distinct and separate? And those two things, if we understand those two tension points, we will begin to recognize how the world is changing all around us, and then not to react to it, but to respond in love, to respond in truth, to respond in power. But we need to get the foundation right. And the Christian community itself is completely confused already. Oneness has become a principle that is accepted even within the Christian community. I believe it was Barna that came out with a survey not that long ago that demonstrated roughly 24 to 25% of the proclaiming Christian community in the United States accepts the tenets of oneism. That's a quarter of the Christians out there that, and you know, for the most part, we've accepted it without even questioning. So it's time to wake up. It's time to question what you're being told by the media, by the world around you, by the culture. It's time to wrestle through the question, big question, the fundamental question. Is reality one or is reality two? And then work through the consequences and the responses that comes with it so that we can be salt and light, so that we don't get our rear ends kicked, so that we can be literally the ambassadors for Christ. Hey, Psalm 96, 1-3 says it this way. And to me, this is beautiful because this is the Great Commission in the Old Testament. This is what we've all been called to do. And that includes you, me, Doug. That includes your listening audience. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord, all the earth. Sing to the Lord, praise his name. Here it is. Proclaim his salvation day after day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous deeds among all peoples. Listen, the world is giving us a salvation message. It's an alternative salvation message. We need to be sure of the true salvation message of Jesus Christ.
Amen.
Amen, indeed. I can't wait to, Steve, I can't wait to be at the conference. I can't wait to hear Carl Teichreb. You know, this is going to be fantastic. 100%. And by the way, folks, please purchase your tickets as soon as possible for the True Legends Conference. It's going to come. I mean, life comes at you fast. This is going to come at us pretty quickly in terms of time. It's already first week of February. So this is going to be in July. It's earlier this year. Hear Carl speak. His website, gameofgods.ca. His book, Game of Gods, The Temple of Man in the Age of Reenchantment. I'm going to tell you, this is a fantastic book. I would recommend getting this book in advance of the conference. Highly recommend it. It's well researched. What does it have, Carl? Like 2,000 footnotes or something? I mean, it's crazy.
1,800 exactly.
Okay. That was close. I mean, I talk about well researched. And you know, Steve, I can't wait for this, and I thank you for setting this up. But of course, the conference tickets are available at gen6.com. And, gentlemen, thank you both. Steve, I want to just say thank you very much. And you know what, Steve? Let me ask you on air. This is a good thing to ask you on air. If you were to title this episode of the Hagman Report, or even Carl chime in 30 seconds here, what would you title this as? Because, you know, so important to really get the message across.
I guess I would call it, the ultimate choice. Choose ye this day whom you're going to follow. Or I would also say, and then Carl, you give your, you know, I'm trying to put it in the context of everything I know, but just hearing what Carl said, you know, an insider's report on the real world, and it's not what you think, something like that. An insider's report on the real world, or a glimpse, you know, I guess what I'm saying, I'd say, and my footnote, Doug, from you would be, Carl sees it coming. Do you even understand what's coming?
That's,
you know,
true.
Something. Yeah. So, and I think it's a good thing. The thing, the key is if you're on a train getting ready to run off the tracks, you want to have gotten off that train to whatever, you know, to perdition or your end at the last stop. And I think that understanding this stuff will give us the, if you will, the train stops to look forward, because everybody's got to get off that train, because the end of that train ends in, I believe, eternal damnation, destruction, and the forfeiting of everything that God in the 139 Psalm states, that his thoughts are more numerous than the sand of the sea towards each and every one of us. Carl, thank you. It was a delight to meet you. Obviously, I'll be talking to you at Branson. And again, I think if I had to say one more thing, Doug, about Branson, this year will be different. It's going to be much more in depth, but it's going to be very, very neat. When I say very, very neat, I think that, Carl, I just said this, it's like all the puzzle pieces that are out there, I think God's going to accelerate the puzzle coming together. We've got the framework, we've got this piece, that piece, you've got your piece, I got my piece. Every speaker has their specific a piece of the puzzle. But I think this year God's going to do something amazing. He's going to bring all those pieces together. And Doug, people have got to sign up as quick as they can because Branson gets really busy in July. So we want to make sure we've got a lot of hotels set aside and stuff, but we have to have people register now. Live streaming won't become available until March 1st, okay? We will offer it, but not until March 1st. So in the time that we have, ladies and gentlemen, get Game of Gods, because again, you know, at the end that you come to 69, how old are you, Carl, may I ask?
50, coming on 52.
Okay. Well, so 17 years his senior, I got to tell you something. Going back, this man has got a mantle of one of the greatest thinkers in Christianity, in my opinion, was Francis Schaeffer, telling us where we would be now. And he's got a mantle equal to and greater than, because his is for the right time at the right place.
All right, brother.
Bye-bye, Carl.
Guys, have a great day. Thank you, Carl. All right, we're out of time. Folks, that'll do it. Good night.